Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast, the podcast for serious lacrosse players and their supporters to help further their development and navigate their way throughout their lacrosse careers. And now, here are your hosts, New England Lacrosse Journal's Kyle Devitt and Jack Piatelli.
Welcome to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. I'm your host, Kyle Devitt. Alongside me, the wonderful Jack Piatelli, who presented our producer, Steve Safran, and I with some Piatelli lacrosse gear. And I gotta say, it's about time.
It was time, but you know, you have to earn it. You know, it's taken you a few months to earn the gear. Not everybody gets to wear the Piatelli gear. Now you're going to be a very proud man now that I have the opportunity to wear the gear.
I will absolutely wear it during podcasts.
Appreciate it.
I don't know where other locations I will list it, but I will definitely wear it during the podcast, especially the hat. Always love a good hat. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Our guest today, Colby head coach Guy Van Arsdale, one of the few goalies that is a head coach at a very high level in lacrosse.
Yeah, one of the greatest all-time goaltenders, four-time All-American at Hobart, won four national championships, and goaltender of the year, I think, three times. He's coached at Penn State, UMass, Notre Dame, Jacksonville, and I think he's really found a really great place for him to not only develop players but build a program that's going to be very successful in a very competitive league, as we know, the NESCAC.
Yeah, and, you know, this is one of the most unpredictable years ever in the history of the NESCAC. I can't wait to ask him about that. And also, you know, get his thoughts on what it's like to coach in Maine. I mean, he's got kids from California on his – not kids 1-2. Kids plural, like 6-7 from very warm states. And he got them to go all the way to Maine. Can't wait to talk to him. Let's hear what he has to say. Colby head coach, Guy Van Arsdale.
Coach, how are you today?
I'm doing great, Jack. Great to be with you guys.
You certainly have put your time in lacrosse. You've got a fabulous reputation in the game, not only as a player. You were an outstanding goaltender in high school and college and a number of Hall of Fames. Your dad was an influence in your game. And Dave Urich, just talk a little bit how you got started in the game and why you continue to coach and what the game has meant to you.
Well, I think that might take up the whole podcast, but I think, I got started in the game when I was about 10 or 11 years old. My family moved to Geneva, New York. My dad had gotten a job at Hobart College. And at that time, you know, Hobart was one of the best lacrosse programs in the country. This is in the early 1970s. And I was, like I said, 10 or 11. And at the time, Jerry Schmidt was the head coach there. Jerry Schmidt, for those who follow lacrosse history, know that he's the only lacrosse player ever to have his picture on the cover of Sports Illustrated when he played at Hopkins. And then Dave Urich was his assistant. And so those two guys had a lot, gave me my first lacrosse stick. My brother, Mark, and I both became ball boys for the Hobart lacrosse team. And every day after school, we would hop on our bikes, take our sticks out of our lockers, and pedal across town to practice every day. We weren't just ball boys at games. We went to practice every day, hung out in the locker room, you know, got taped in the lockers, the whole nine yards. And it got in our blood. And there were so many generous people who taught us how to play, taught us how to be what good teammates look like. And Hobart was competing for national championships at that time. So it got in our blood early. And I can't, you know, my whole life, I think I went to college thinking about, you know, I didn't look at it. I applied early to admit at Hobart because I just loved the place. My brother was the same way, and lucky enough to win four national championships there because we were surrounded by such great players. And Dave Urich was the head coach at that point and was one of the most amazing human beings I've ever been around in my life as a mentor, as a man, and certainly as a lacrosse coach. So I've been really fortunate. And then when I got out, I knew that lacrosse was what I wanted to do. It had shaped my life so far and had shaped it well. So I was trying to find ways to stay in it and then ways to give back to it. And I was fortunate enough, I coached for 2 years at Hobart, and then I went to UMass for 3 years in the late 80s. We had some great teams, and was able to be an assistant coach for Dick Garber, who was another legend in the game, and probably, you know, one of the best gentlemen you would have ever met, and if you were lucky enough to know Dick. And so I had an early influences that taught me a lot about as much about being a man and a good man as it did the love for the game. So I was very, very fortunate right from the start.
Coach, you were a goalie, and I'm always fascinated when I talk to a coach that was a goalie, because the short list in my head of coaches that have been very successful at the college level that were goalies is John Tillman, Paul Schmoller, and Steve Kadelka. And I can't, and now I'm talking to you, and I can't think of that many. It's just one of those positions that doesn't, I don't think a lot of players come out and that are goalies that become, you know, very successful long-term head coaches. What was your path through that from being a goalie? Like, what do you think there's an advantage to being a goalie and then becoming a coach? And if so, like, what is it?
Well, I think certainly there's an advantage in that you have a perspective of the game that's somewhat unique.
Right.
And the view you have of the game be as a player. But I also think, you know, there's a certain level of humility that comes with being a goaltender, you know, because, you know, you're the only guy in the field that they count your mistakes on the scoreboard, you know? And so you have to have a certain level of a thick skin and humility, and you certainly need that in coaching. And I think one of the first things I learned when I first started coaching, the first couple of years of coaching, when I got out of college, was that as a player, everyone thought I was, you know, had high lacrosse IQ, knew the game and everything. And when I started coaching, I realized I knew nothing about the game. And so I think that's where the humility piece came in, and was just so open to learning from as many people as I possibly can. And so then over my career, you know, I've been a defensive coordinator, I've been an offensive coordinator, but the one thing that's been constant is that I've always been able to coach the goalies on whatever team I'm coaching. And that adds an advantage that you have probably in any team that I've coached. You know, one of the most undercoached positions has a specific coach for that position. And I think the goalkeeper position is probably the most, you know, most undercoached position there is in the game, has been and still is. And even some of those folks and undercoach, not only just lack of coaching, but lack of what I think is real knowledgeable coaching.
Now, Coach, the coaching you had at Hobart as a goaltender, do you coach the same way today as you were coached, or have you changed it a little bit? Have you had like a sort of an evolution as time has gone on with coaching your goalies? And the other question is, why is it that goaltenders don't get the attention they deserve? Because I think probably the most important position in the game, especially today. You know, they don't get the practice time or the attention to practice that they should be getting, more so than, you know, some of the rest of the players.
Well, I would certainly agree with that. And to start with the first part of your question is, no, I certainly don't coach it the way I was coached, even though I think I was really well coached at the time. And a lot of that was by Dave Urich, who was self-taught and went out, and he hadn't been a goal. I mean, Dave Urich didn't play high school lacrosse. He didn't play lacrosse until he went to college at Cortland State, you know, and then became one of the most decorated and successful coaches our game has ever known. And then, I think there's a lot of evolution of the game. I think the evolution of equipment has changed the game. It's changed how you need to play in the goal. I think the ideas of positioning and movement have changed in the goal. And then I think all of those things have come together. And then I think, you know, the reason that it, you know, part of the problem is that people think if they're shooting on goalies are getting work, and that warm up is goalie work. And it's not. Warm up is warm up. You know, the warming up a goalie is the same thing as the rest of the team doing their stretching and dynamic warm up for practice. That's what a goalie warm up is. And so many people make the mistake of thinking, well, I gave the goalie his time, I warmed him up before practice or at the beginning of practice, or he got a warm up, so he's all set. But meanwhile, we'll then go into practice and we'll break down a position and we'll work on, you know, footwork dodging with midfielders, and attackmen will work on, you know, moves coming around the cage and get to the 5x5, and defensemen will work on holds and approaches and things like that. And meanwhile, the goalie's in the corner doing who knows what, you know, long passes or something. But that's a time where goalies should be having specific things to their position to work on as well, is fundamentally sound. I think a lot of people miss the boat on that.
And explain that, like what should goalies be working on when they're over in the corner? Is it footwork? Is it hand-eye coordination?
Well, I think all the answer to that is yes, right? I think it's all those things, but I think you need to be very specific in what you have your goaltenders doing. And also you need to spend time with them, and they need to be in the cage. You know, I'm not a big, you know, lots of toys and gimmicks and things like that. You know, the best thing you can do is be in the pipes and working in there, and not necessarily shooters, but hard shooters, you know, and you can be shooting the ball at 50% or 40% of velocity and working on sound techniques. And it may be different aspects. Maybe you're working on shooters coming around the cage, or you're working on turns on a fade or your feed, or you're working on footwork of moving from across the top if a pass is passes thrown wing to wing, or if you're working from a pass from behind the cage to the top step down, what's your footwork look like there, and where should your hand position be, and what positions do you want to get into, and what type of arc are you working on? So all of those types of things, and you pick out one of those phases and work on it for those 15 minutes. You don't try to fit everything into that 15 minutes or whatever you set aside for practice time there, and you work on one phase and try to have your guys get that down so that they can also work that on their own too. But you want to work with them. You don't want to just throw them in the corner and hope that they're doing it right.
Coach, I'm going to keep hammering this goalie thing on, because I actually love the unique perspective of a coach that is a goalie and played goalie. And I never did it. There's not enough money in the world. There's not enough accolades in the world that one could win being a goalie for me. I know a lot of lacrosse players feel that way. There takes a special kind of person to be a goalie. So let me ask you some goalie specific questions. Not rapid fire, but I think you can string these all together. Big goalie or little goalie, and high arc or flat arc, and do lefties really change shooters?
The lefties thing I think is negligible. With the development of the game and the way kids handle the stick and the way sticks are made and the way they shoot the ball, big goalies are better than little goalies. And the arc piece, I would like to blow that out of the water. That's a false choice.
Okay.
That there's not a flat arc, high arc. In fact, I've been teaching for a long time what I call a changing arc, so that we don't work on just a horizontal plane. We also work on a vertical plane. And so we work not only pipe to pipe, but we work crease to top of arc as our two planes. And in those planes, you know, the farther the ball is from the cage, the farther you are from the cage, you're probably better off. The closer the ball is to the cage, the closer you can be to the goal line of the cage. And again, this would take, you know, you and I would need to do a whole video of this to really explain it, but it's what we teach. And it's what I truly believe is the way to play it. And if people are giving just those two choices, you know, drives me nuts when I see goalies playing one way or the other, or thinking they have to be going one way or another, because so much of goalie play today. And I firmly believe this, it's, you know, it's great to have fast hands and be quick. You know, that separates a lot of kids, but the most important thing is just to be in the right place, be in the right place and be there early.
When you're
in the right place, then you can kind of live by the mantra of making the shooter make a perfect shot, right? And then always putting it so that he has to, so that you have the upper hand. You're dictating what he has to do. And you do that, you force shooters to make the perfect shot by being in the perfect position. And sometimes that's in tighter, sometimes that's out further, but it's, you know, and on that vertical plane as well as the horizontal plane.
That's interesting, because that's actually exactly how I coach it, without using good words like you just use, where I will just say, okay, I'm going to shoot here, try to stop it. This is why you didn't stop it. You're not in the right position. If you take a half step off your pipe, half step diagonal, like you have a much better angle. I have less to shoot at, you know, and like, then I pull the goalie out of goal and I show him where I am and what I'm seeing. And then I have the backup goalie go in and move him, and they go, oh, Okay. Especially with like, I coached a brand new goalie that never played sports at all last year. And it was, talk about humbling. Yeah. Probably the most humbling thing I've ever done as a coach or a player or anything. But we got there, right? Like you learn like the basics and the techniques. And that's why I'm always fascinated to talk to coaches that are goalie specialists and played the position, because they have such a different view of it as someone that is a shooter or someone that warms up goalies or something like that. You know, like every team has the guy like, oh, I want to warm up the goalie. And it's like, no, you can't warm up the goalie because you want to shoot. You right. have to actually have purpose when you're shooting and communication with the goalie and what he wants.
And there's right. And if you're doing that specific goalie time that we talked about earlier, then you can have kids shoot, because sometimes it's a good thing, you know, not for sustained periods. And you know, certainly put boundaries on where shooters can be. But having two or three shooters moving the ball and a goalie in the cage and letting it fly, you know, that's not all bad either. And it's not like they should do it a lot, you know, tons of time, or that's all they should do. But if that's in concert with the teaching moments and teaching periods and working on the technical sound aspect of things, because it's not just getting to those spots that you're talking about, right. but how do we get that spot? Did I move the proper leg at the proper time? Is it like, if I'm coming off the pipe, I want to come with the pipe leg first. I don't want to come with the off pipe leg. It's all these type of things. Am I flat to the pipe? Am I off the pipe? You know, there's so many things in terms of that are nuanced, that if I guarantee you that, you know, the vast majority of people who even know the game are watching that and will not understand the nuance of what the goaltender is doing if they've spent a lot of time working on those small pieces.
Also, I forgot to say Bill Pilot earlier, so people in the comments yeah. can calm down. I know I missed it. I was like, I missed a goalie coach. Right. Oh, the most famous one. Right. Good job, Kyle.
Yeah.
Let me follow that up with one. Like, we're going to move on to other stuff, I swear, but it's so fascinating to me to talk to goalies. What is one thing that you could tell to a goalie at any level that makes them better? What's one thing, one piece of advice you could give them that makes them better?
Lead with your hands. Cause the major mistake that I see being taught to a lot of goalkeepers today is what I call the two wides. Your hands are too wide apart and your feet are too wide apart. And if you see goalies who are flopping on the ground a lot, they're probably too wide. To me, the greatest goalies in the game today always have been and still are today the ones who make the tough save look easy. And I think there's a lot of people teaching methodologies now that make the easy save look tough.
Interesting. That's a very interesting point. Yeah. You believe that? Obviously.
Wholeheartedly.
Wow. They make the easy save look hard.
I've written that, actually. You can see that if you watch a ton of tape on a certain goalie. You can definitely see it.
Well, to me, there's nothing more demoralizing to a shooter than a kid lets the ball fly from, you know, from a good angle, good distance, and he knows he just nailed that. And the goalie just reaches over and plucks it out of the air, or reaches down and plucks it and doesn't look like he moved. And it's like, oh my God, that's the best I have. And that guy just ate it up like it was a snack. So I think that there's so much of that, I think, that can have something to do. Cause then you get the other piece. If you're doing that, and you're always in the right position, then some of the very best saves you make, you may never touch the ball, because now you got guys who are so worried about getting the ball to a right spot. It's going over the net. It's going wide. It's doing, you know, and some of the, you know, I tell our goalies, we talk about ghost saves, right? Those yep. are saves that they never touched, but because they were in the right place and had been moving right, they're in the shooter's head.
Yeah.
And that I have we're to asking shoot. The shooter to make that perfect shot, and he can't.
Yeah, when you're like, I have to shoot harder because he saved this one that should have gone in, like, that's absolutely a real thing.
Yeah, when you get the shooter thinking when he's shooting, then the shooter's in trouble, for sure. So, Coach, tell us a little bit about your team, and I know you're excited to get going. You know, we've had a couple of tough goes these last few years, but I got to ask you, you're opening up against Tufts.
Yeah, for the third year in a row.
That's fantastic.
It's not just Tufts. We open up Tufts Williams Wesleyan, our first three nests. So we're playing the three top ranked teams in our conference our first three games. So I'm not sure who I ticked off at the NESCAC, but somebody doesn't like me there. You know, but we love the challenge. We love the fact that we'll be able to take a measure of who we are early. and that we'll have a chance to coach up and improve and we have a chance to do some things that, you know, frankly, haven't been done here before. So I think those are all great opportunities, and those are the opportunities you want. It's why you play in the NESCAC. It's why kids come to NESCAC schools. It's why kids come to Colby, is because they can have, you know, a world-class education, but then also have the opportunity to play the very best lacrosse in the country. And I think that's, we're excited for those opportunities. It's, you know, we certainly don't have any, as Dave Urich always used to say, you know, respect all opponents, fear none. And I think that's how we look at this. So I think we're excited. We think we have a good group of guys. You know, we're, I think like everybody else, you know, it's the last 2 years, you know, we have a junior class that have only played in 7 college lacrosse games. So it's kind of interesting to, I'll have an expectation of a junior in practice or in a scrimmage, and then I'll have to tone it down a little bit because I realize he hasn't played any games, you know, and then I'm getting ready to yell at our assistant coach because we're not subbing properly. And I don't understand why we're, and it's like, 'cause these kids haven't done it, you know? And so it's like, it's interesting how you have to change your perspective in preparing the kids and change some expectations. But I think the one thing we've done well here the last few years since we've gotten here, you know, the year before we got here, you know, went through the whole tragedy of Jack Sandler and Jack passing. And, you know, that's something we think about a lot and respect, you know, Jack's legacy. But that team went through hell and didn't win an NESCAC game that season. So it's been kind of a slow build back. And I think we're getting there. We're getting the kind of kids we want here. We're getting the talent we want here. And I think we have a locker room right now that's full of guys who really buy into our culture, really understand what kind of commitment and sacrifice you have to make to be successful at this level. And I think a lot of that has been, you know, kind of a slow turn to get there. But you throw that on top with some talented kids, that's the key. But it's, you know, one or the other is great, but you can't get far with just one or the other. You need talent and you need the right culture. And I think we're heading in that direction. So I'm interested for us to go play because I have no idea what anyone else has either, because I think they're in the same boat we are. And I think until you get on the field and line up and go for a sustained period, not just one game, but, you know, 5, 6, 7 games in, I think then you'll have an idea where you are.
Coach, you, like I said earlier, you've coached at every level. You've coached in a number of different conferences, whether it's Division I, II, or III. Where do you rate the NESCAC conference compared to some of the other conferences you've coached at?
Well, I think, you know, in terms of Division III, I can't imagine that there's top to bottom, there's nothing like this. And I think, you know, I tell people all the time, it's a conference that the kids love to play in and the coaches hate to coach it. You know, it's just one right after the other. And there's just no days off. I don't care who you're playing in the conference on any given day, you know, any given Wednesday or Saturday, you know, a NESCAC score won't surprise me in any direction. So I think that's the beauty of our conference. And it's full of a lot of really talented guys, players, and it's full of some really, really good coaches and fun guys to coach against and be associated with. So I think that really makes us different in a lot of ways.
Coach, this might be the most unpredictable year in the history of the NESCAC, because you have 3 teams coming back that didn't play last year and had limited action in 2020 in, you know, Middlebury, Amherst, and Bowdoin. And I did previews for them. I wrote them up this week on laxjournal.com. And some of them don't even have their rosters up. So how are you preparing for that as a coach and seeing, you know, I mean, Middlebury has like 50 guys, which no one is surprised by this. No one should be surprised by anything that's happening. Bill Mason getting hired at Bowdoin, Sean Woods getting hired at Amherst. You've got new coaches everywhere. You got players that have, like you said, have only played 7 games, all up and down, all these rosters. How do you prep for that?
Well, I think it's the same way. It's the same way you prep always. You take care of yourself first, right? You make sure your house is in order before you start looking at what other people are building, you know? And I think that's the big thing. I think because we know each other's programs so well in this conference, or coaches, even with the new coaches, you know, you'll have some idea. You know, style of play, right? You know, we know how Tufts wants to play. We know how Wesleyan wants to play. We know how, you know, we understand these types of things of what they want to do, just like they know how we want to play. And so I don't think there's a lot of mystery about scheme. The mystery will be about who's executing the scheme and what do you need to do to adjust to, you know, new players in who there'll be I'll step on a field one game this spring against our opponents, and there'll be a kid's name we'll scout that and look. It's like, geez, that kid's really lightning. And it'll be a name I haven't heard since we were involved in recruiting the kid 4 years ago, you know? And then it's like, that's useless information at that point. And so it's, that's going to be the biggest thing is understanding personnel. Cause I think we'll understand each other's schemes.
Well, that being said, like, how do you want to play? What is your ideal mode of execution? Is it tempo control? Is it, you know, fast, like literally every other team is trying to do? What is your preference for how your team wants to play?
Well, what we always say is that, you know, I've been doing this almost 40 years and have coached probably any style you can imagine. I've probably had teams who embrace that type of style, from, you know, zone teams to doubling defenses to shutoffs to, you know, flying up and down the field to two-way midfielders to platoon, whatever it is. And what my answer to that question is always is, if you tell me who my players are, I'll tell you what our style of play is, because our job is to take our kids and, you know, help them to hone and identify their strengths and put them in positions in game situations where they're able to use those strengths more than anything else, and combine them with other kids out there whose strengths complement their own and are not necessarily repetitive of their strengths. So I think with that in mind, you know, we're more athletic than we've been. I think we're going to be a little bit better at the defensive end than we've been. I think we've got a couple of goal scorers. So I think a lot of it is we're still discovering what we're best at. And I think that's part of what not playing really hurts us. But I think we're a team that I would say that if there's opportunity to go, we go. If there's not, we'll be comfortable not going too. So we don't want to pigeonhole ourselves into a specific thing, so that if you take that one thing away, we're done. We don't want to be that kind of team. We want to be the kind of team that if you take A away, we've got B in the wings ready to go. If you adjust to B, here comes C. And so those are the type of ways we try to prepare, and the way that we want to go into things.
New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal will return after this message.
The Men's Lacrosse Championships, where speed and power meets precision and creativity. And they give it everything they got, from face-off to the final whistle. Go big for every goal. Go beyond your limits and enter the NCAA universe. The Men's Lacrosse Championships, May 28th through 30th at Rensselaer Field in East Hartford, Connecticut. Get your seats today at ncaa.com/mlacrosse.
Are you serious about playing your sport in college? Do you need a flexible education that allows you to maintain your practice and competition schedules while also preparing you to succeed at the next level? You should check out the University of Nebraska High School. UNHS is accredited and offers more than 100 online courses, including NCAA-approved courses to protect your academic eligibility. Students could earn a UNHS diploma or take a single course for transfer credit. Courses are college prep, self-paced, and available 24/7, 365. Enroll anytime and take up to a year to complete a course. Visit highschool.nebraska.edu today.
Looking to keep up with all the latest news and information on New England lacrosse? New England Lacrosse Journal and LaxJournal.com are the premier resources for information and inspiration on the New England lacrosse scene. Have every issue of New England Lacrosse Journal, the magazine, delivered to your home or office. And don't forget to stay in the game every day with a digital subscription to LaxJournal.com to receive daily digital lacrosse coverage on club lacrosse, college commits, prep and high school, Division I, II, and III colleges, showcases, rankings, and much more. Get in the game and behind the scenes now by logging on to LaxJournal.com. Just click on the subscribe button and start the subscription that is right for you today. New England Lacrosse Journal is a Siemens Media publication. Siemens Media, inspiring, informative, insightful.
In terms of recruiting, so you're going to recruit the best available players who fit your culture versus trying to recruit players that fit a system because the system doesn't fit the player. You're just looking for players who can play at that level, help your program, and be good teammates. And again, it's all about the culture.
It is. I would describe it this way, that when we start recruiting, and obviously you're out, you know, watching kids play or you're getting film or kids, obviously the first thing that catches your attention that may interest you in a kid is his ability, right? Is his athleticism, his skill set, his, you know, how he plays the game. Is he, you know, does he play with a chip on his shoulder that we like to have, or does he stay outside the fray? You know, those types of things that you can see on film that gets you interested. And so from there, then we look into, you know, is this guy, we love his talent. Are we going to like anything about him? And so that I would say that's not what makes us recruit him, but what makes us look if we want to recruit him. So then we go into, you know, the character and culture fit, as you're talking about. Those are the next thing. And obviously for any NESCAC, but certainly for Colby, academic acumen, you know, we had 17,000 applications last year for 550 spots. So our admit rate is right around or just below 9%. So we're looking for kids who aren't just great lacrosse players, but we need great students as well. So it's that becomes the challenge. And we eliminate a lot of people because of that, right? It's like there's not a lot of folks who are going to fit into that category. And that's why we have a team that has, you know, 12 or 14 states represented. And we got 6 or 7 kids from California and kids from Illinois and Florida, Georgia, and then all throughout the North Atlantic. So and New England. So I think, you know, those things are important, but it's the recruiting piece is always going to be about that culture, because if you're not going to fit that or you don't have the character, we're just not going to bother with it. And as I tell people all the time, that one of my shortcomings as a human being, as I've aged, is that I just don't suffer fools well, and I'm just not going to have them in our program.
It's a very good point, Coach. Question, in terms of your players and when they come in, as freshmen, how long does it take them to get adjusted to the academic and the athletic, challenges that are ahead of them? Depend on the kid itself, or like, it must be very difficult going from high school to a Colby where the academic and the athletic piece is very demanding and challenging for these young kids.
Absolutely. Because as you're saying, they're not just bigger, faster, stronger on the field. They're bigger, faster, stronger in the classroom too. And so I think those muscles are just as important and have a lot to do, you know, if a freshman or a first year can come in and get himself acclimated and feel comfortable academically, the quicker he does that, the better his lacrosse tends to go. Because if he has that other piece hanging over him off the field, it's very difficult to separate that from what you're doing on the field, because it's why they're here, right? And it's tell kids, it's why they're here. Like, you're here to get a world-class education that's gonna lead you to live the life you want to lead, you know? And so you need to take care, and we do everything we can to support and also to fill in the gaps the kids may have when they first get here academically. Now, fortunately, a lot of these kids are smart. You know, they figure it out fast. Colby does an amazing job of supporting first-year students and acclimating them and giving them the tools they need to find success, to the point where if you're not succeeding here, you're going out of your way to not succeed. It may still be difficult and may require work, but if you're not succeeding, it's because you fought the system, you know, and didn't allow yourself to receive help and do the things you need to do. And when that part's going well, it's amazing how that translates to things going well on the field. So we spend a lot of time to make sure that part's going well, so that when it comes time to be on the field or in the weight room or doing the things that they need to do, they don't have that hanging over their head and keeping them from becoming, you know, the very best that they can be.
Coach, the stat you mentioned, 17,000 applicants, only 550 students admitted to Colby. Does that make it more challenging for you as a coach to bring in the number of players you need year to year?
I would say it doesn't, not the number, you know, in terms of just quantity, but it's certainly, you know, you're talking about a finite pool of guys who have the kind of talent, character, and academic acumen that we're looking for to be successful here at Colby. That's not a huge number of people, but they're there. And I think that's, so it's our job to find them wherever they are and to, you know, kind of open the doors of Colby to them. I mean, you know, our most challenging piece in recruiting, our most challenging piece is not getting kids to understand what we have, but just getting families to visit, you know, because we're in Central Maine. And ridiculously so, and it makes sense, you know, our probably yield rate or close rate, I guess, if you're using sales terms, of families who visit Colby and then decide to come here is astronomical. We're unbelievably successful. When people see it, they're like, oh my God. And that's, you know, Colby has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in the last 5 years into the town of Waterville and into Colby. I mean, we're working out of a new $200 million athletic center. You know, we've got new turf on every field out there. We've got, you know, all kinds of things that our weight room went from, you know, in the last 2 years went from 4,000 square feet to 14,000 square feet with every piece of equipment you can imagine and opportunities for guys to lift and train and indoor facilities and things. So it's, you know, we've got, people need to see that firsthand. It's been an interesting process and more people are starting to realize that. And realize the opportunity. And when they get here, it's like, holy smoke. Now I know what you're talking about. We just thought you were a coach, you know? So it's, they start to take that seriously.
I think my follow-up question before you even said all that was, how did you get six kids from California to go to Maine? But like, I mean, the NESCAC and the school sells itself, right? Like in a certain capacity, like you've said, it's the NESCAC is academically, I believe every coach has used this term, rigorous. In terms of
I would say this, Kyle, is that the academic levels of NESCAC schools and for us, I would say that because Colby is who Colby is on an international scale in terms of name recognition for its academic, you know, being an elite academic institution, that opens doors. It doesn't bring kids here, but it certainly opens doors and it opens doors wherever we go. So that's what allows us to go. So those doors in California open up because it's like, oh, Colby, that's a hell of a school. We'd be lucky if our kid could get in and get an education from Colby. Maybe we should listen to these people. And so then when they listen to it and then do their due diligence to find out what and how we do things, then they're making the choice to be a part of it.
And you have recruited at the Division I level and now at the NESCAC level. What is the biggest difference other than, you know, clearinghouse and things like that? Because the academic piece, I think, you know, like we hammer it because it needs to be hammered. Because I think a lot of people just are like, oh, he'll go to a NESCAC. And it's like, he won't go to a NESCAC unless he takes AP classes, you know, things like that. Like, I feel like that is very under not reported, but under not shown enough to young kids trying to play right now.
Well, I think the most important thing to tell, you know, kids even going into their freshman year or even before that of high school, because your freshman year counts, right? If you get a bunch of C's your freshman year, you might have just got yourself out of the NESCAC, you know, or at least some of the NESCAC schools. And so what you need to understand is that academic success will give you a wealth of opportunities. And so if you don't know, when you're in eighth and ninth grade, you have no idea how good you're going to be in 4 years. You may think, you know, but you have no idea. And you want to have as many options as possible 4 years, you know, 3 years from then. And academic success is the absolute best way to create those opportunities, not how many goals you score. Now that's going to be important. It's a factor in terms of where the level you land. But the number of opportunities and educational opportunities will be solely dictated by what you do in the classroom. And that's why that's so, so important for kids to understand it. They think they're going to play their way. Look, I mean, let's face it, you know, even at the Division I level in lacrosse, there's what, 70 Division I lacrosse programs in the country, in the NCAA? That's it. And not all of them are fully funded. So if you think you're going to get money to go, and the number of, you know, full scholarship athletes at Division I, you probably can count on one hand in the country. You know, and it's always been that way. And certainly money's there, and that becomes a more of a factor in Division I than Division III in terms of scholarship dollars. But the other piece of it is that there's 275 men's Division III programs in the country. So you tell me, where is there going to be more opportunities? And they're going to be all based upon your academic acumen as to where you can get to in those places. And so if you want to create those opportunities that are realistic, then let's face it. You better get to work. You know, it's great to go work on shooting and do that, but make sure you do it after your homework's done, you know, and done well. So I think that's the best way you can set yourself up and set kids up, and, you know, try to parent kids and coach kids to understand. And I know it's hard for kids to understand that, but there's time and place, right? It's and talking to as many people who've gone through those experiences for young people, I think is as important, because it's not just a matter of, hey, get good grades. It's like, no, it's like, go to work, learn, get an education, learn how to be educated, learn how to learn and how to apply yourself and have a hunger for that, because that's going to create the opportunity for you.
So we've kind of gone over the, you know, obviously you have the academic piece and you have the ability piece. What are the intangibles of a student athlete to succeed at Colby? What do they need to have as a characteristic?
Well, I think one of the important things, and I think this is important for anybody, especially, and if you're thinking about being a Division I player or just a really successful college athlete, you have to have a high degree of self-motivation. You have to be able to get up and do the stuff you don't want to do and do it well when you don't feel like doing it. And if the only way you can do that is by having, you know, somebody encourage you to do that or bark at you to do that, then you're just not going to get very far. You're just not. And you're not going to get as far as you think you can. You have to find ways to kind of, you know, get through it when you don't feel like doing it. And we're all human beings, even things we love, you know, as human beings, even things we love to do, there's days we just don't feel like doing it. And that's natural, and that's okay. It's okay to feel that way. But what do you do with those feelings? How do you put those aside and do what you're doing well in that moment when you don't feel like doing it? That is a differentiator of the largest magnitude. And it's really hard to measure in recruiting. It's really hard to measure in recruiting. So you spend time getting to know families and kids and talking to coaches and all those types of things about a young man and to see what kind of thing there is, you know, but in the end, it comes out, you know, cause you'll have guys, you know, and I would say that that's a lot of guys who maybe have tons of talent and have lived on their talent and they're great athletes and they get to places and they're really challenged. And now it's time to do things you don't feel like, and they don't. And it's like, geez, that guy never panned out. I would venture a guess that more kids don't pan out at places where they thought they had a high end to achieve or could achieve. Most kids don't pan out because of that, because they lack that piece, and that it requires somebody. Because I'll tell you what, you go to any college lacrosse program, and what's the average roster now? Somewhere between 42 and, hell, at Division I, it's 65 for some places now. You know, and if you're one of those guys and there's only three coaches on the team and there's 50 guys out there, how much individual attention do you really think you're going to get from a coach in terms of motivating you individually? You know, coaches will try to get a team going on, but it's, you know, you're speaking to 50 different guys, maybe only eight hear what you're saying that hits their heart. And you got to say it differently to hit another eight and all those types. So if you're one of those guys who can't do that, then I think you're in trouble.
Coach, what do you like your roster size to be from year to year? And what do you tend to like to bring in terms of recruits year to year?
Well, we're in the low to mid 40s in our roster. And part of that's because, you know, we have guys who, you know, have academic commitments and may not, maybe late or leave of practice early, which is fine. We deal with that. We'll have, you know, if you got a couple of kids banged up, because we like to, we do a very, what I would call high energy, high intensity practices. And there's just not a lot of standing around, and there's a lot of people engaged all the time. You know, rarely do we have everybody at one end and go six on six. And we'll do that when maybe we're injuries or we're trying to hone something down, but not for very long. But we're all over the place, and small groups, large groups, all types of things. So I think you need to have those numbers. And we're to the point now where I would anticipate that in the first half of a game, we'll play 26, 27 players in the first half of a game now. So that's not in a game that we have control of. That's in any game. We'll be trying to do that. We want to engage as many guys as we can and then develop behind that. So I think that's the important part. So the roster's tough in that way. And always the greatest challenge, I think, for any coach is keeping those, you know, those 15 kids who didn't get in the game engaged. They didn't get in the game on Saturday, and keeping them engaged on Monday, because they're a huge part of your team's development. And they have to understand, you know, where their role is, where their opportunity is, how being engaged, as hard as it is in that moment, because it doesn't feel like you get a payoff. And Lord knows we're in an instant payoff culture, you know, and if you don't get that payoff, putting the time in will give you the chance to pay off. Not putting the time in locks you into the position you're in. And so that's an easy way of saying it, you know, but you have to find different ways as a coach to help kids understand that and help them grow through that and love them through that. I mean, those kids need to be loved just as much as the kids, you know, who are on the field. So those things are important.
Because of the COVID situation we were in, you were able to play fall ball this past fall. You're able to start your season earlier this year. Are you in favor of continuing that going forward?
Oh my God, yes. Yes, please. If you have any pull on that, please make it happen. And I think for lots of reasons, right? And it's only 15 practices, right? That's nothing.
In the fall.
3 practices a week for 15 practices. But it was actually, you know, our kids came back who had done captain's practices in the fall for years and just said, this was so much better. Like it was actually less time, but more productive in terms of what they spent on the field. And they just got so much more out of it. And for me personally, it allows me to teach the game. I love to teach the game. And I love to watch kids light up when they get something, you know, when they've, like, you've been working on something for a couple practices or a little bit after practice, trying to develop some skill or some sort of move. And then the kid hits it in practice. And the first thing he does is snaps his head around and looks at you with a big grin on his face. I mean, those moments are gold. That's why I do what I do, right? Those moments are gold. So I think being able to teach the game and watch kids grow in those moments and just being together, you know, our kids did better academically. You know, we had, believe it or not, one of the things that we're finding across the NESCAC is that those programs that were able to have non-traditional seasons are seeing less incidence of mental health issues. And which, as we all know, is, you know, a tremendous, tremendous topic for all of us to be paying attention to right now. Is, you know, kids today are dealing with more anxiety and depression and things than any generation ever has ever. And a lot of it is the things going on. And so being in those situations where you're doing something you love with guys that you love who share that passion and kind of working in the pack mentality, I think it does a lot to helping kids with mental health issues as well.
Yeah, you come be a part of the family early in the process, which really enhances their experience throughout their 4 years at Colby.
No question. It's something that we want them to do. We want them to be part of it as quickly as possible. We want to get them in the family and start loving on them right away.
Coach, I'm gonna kind of, we're running out of time, but I'm gonna ask you an uncomfortable question. And I want to know the answer to it, because it does kind of relate to where I'm from. I'm from New Hampshire, which is very similar to Maine in terms of, you know, population density, shall we say. And also, you know, there's Dartmouth here, so there's rigorous academic institutions as well. you don't have a player from Maine on your roster. Obviously, your role is not to bring in players locally, but you have all these great colleges in Maine. How do you develop the talent at the high school level and the youth level to produce players that can go to school at home where they are? How does that change? What needs to change for that to happen? Because I've always asked this question of where I'm from, and I don't know everything about Maine, but I know a little bit, and it's very similar from what I understand in terms of just because people, you know, tons of people live in Portland, tons of people live near Bangor. It's all like different population centers, but the talent is very, you know, uneven. What needs to happen for that to develop to a higher level, like Massachusetts, for example?
I don't know that it'll ever mirror something like Massachusetts, just for the points you just made about population density, but the, we graduated two Maine players last spring. And so not having a Maine player on the roster is certainly not by design. I can tell you that. Coach just needs to do a better job to convince Maine kids to come here. And we've certainly reached out to some, and just for whatever reasons, it just hasn't come to fruition, but not from lack of effort. Because there are good kids in Maine, and they're good players. And there's like, you know, actually, I've probably done more to help some Maine kids get to other coaches. And, you know, there's a Maine kid at Loyola who I told my brother about that he better get on, and because he was just too damn good, you know, and so now he's at Loyola, and I'm not sure he would have been had that not heads up, not been thrown. So there's lots of things like that, that I think help that those kids going out and doing other things. But I, you know, there's things where our kids are doing clinics for youth in this area. You know, it's tough. It's like, cause even here, you know, over in the high school, the next town over in Messalonskee and in Winslow, both have high school programs, but the town of Waterville itself doesn't have a high school lacrosse program. And just trying to get that is like running into brick walls right now. But we'll do youth clinics. We're going to have a group from actually the Bangor area that's starting a high school program is going to come down. We're working with them. So we're doing what we can. But at the same time, you know, that's a really fine line to walk, Kyle, that the game has given me a lot in my life. So there's a lot I want to do to give back to the game. And I have everywhere I've ever lived, you know, whether it was Colorado or Florida or Pennsylvania or Indiana and any of those places that I coached, they were all kind of outlier program, you know, outlier areas to the home base of the game. But, there's also the fine line of where you as a coach need to do your job as well. And that's why you're here. And so I think everybody has that responsibility and has the responsibility to the kids that you coach in your program. But at the same time, you want to teach them the idea of how to spread. And what I would say, what I think we're very fortunate here is we've got kids who really have a heart for that. And so we're doing more and more of that.
Yeah, coach. I mean, you know, like I said, I tried to preface it with, this is an uncomfortable question.
Yeah.
But I do think it's important for lacrosse to grow in different areas. And you know, being from a super small town myself, I always ask coaches that are in a position to help with that. Cause you know, I had a coach help our team and get helmets. We didn't have helmets. I wore the bucket, even though the regular Cascade had been out.
What's wrong with that, Kyle? I don't understand. That's all I knew.
Let me tell you, it was, it's the least comfortable thing I've ever put on my head. So I don't know how you did that, but you know, thank you for answering that, honestly. And
yeah, honestly, Kyle, that's not a hard question. I mean, I think it's a pretty, you know, if you love the game and the game has given to you, you know, then it's incumbent upon us. If you're that person, it's incumbent upon you to try to find ways, big or small, to impact the game back because you know it can do with people's life. I mean, like one of the things that we're very conscientious of is we have a great relationship with Harlem lacrosse. And so, you know, we have a couple kids that we work very hard at trying to get Harlem kids to have the opportunity to come here to Colby and be a part of our program. So, you know, that's another way that we give back to the game and try to let the game work its magic on other people.
So we try to do with the podcast, right, Jack?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we're happy to do it. And we want to thank you for coming on. It's been great. Good luck this season. That is a wild opening schedule for you, but hey, you are playing against one of my former players that I coached, Bill Cosentino, over with the Monks, St. Joseph, Maine. So, yes. You know, good luck against everyone except them, Coach. Sorry.
I appreciate it, Kyle.
Coach, pleasure having you. Really nice job.
Thanks, Jack. It's my pleasure. Anytime. Love what you guys are doing.
Guy Van Arsdale, what a pleasure. What a great man.
Very good man. One of the great ambassadors of the game. And what I found interesting was just learning more about the goalie position. He talked about the goalie position very differently than I've learned from other coaches who coach that position. And he spends a lot of time with his goaltenders and gives some really good insight about what it takes to be a good goaltender.
I'll tell you what, I was taking notes when he was saying what to do with goalies because, you know, honestly, when I got back into coaching, my first day, I took like 200 shots in that goalie. I barely was able to drive home with my arm. But I remember being like, that was so much fun. It's the most fun part of coaching when you get to shoot on the goalie, but also developing the goalie. And he had a lot to say about that. And I'm going to apply a lot of those lessons this year.
And obviously, he had a lot to say about the school itself, Colby, the unexpected season. You know, they don't really know what's going to happen in terms of the competition until probably 2-3 games into the season. He's starting off with a very difficult first 4 games, 3 out of the 4 in NESCAC's school. So he's excited to get going and runs a fast-paced practice. And, you know, it's very difficult to get into. 17,000 applications. Yeah. 550 students got in.
That's wild. That's much better than our schools put together in terms of acceptance rate. Even if you halved it, I don't think it would be that.
All right, speak for Clark.
Well, no. I think Clark is like 18%. So it's not. It's like 40. But listen, it was great to talk to him. And, you know, he's playing Tufts first, so
give him credit. He's dialed in.
It's rough. That's a rough first game, my man. That's gonna be tough. That's gonna be at Tufts. But we want to thank you again for listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. For Jack Piattelli, I'm Kyle Devitt. We'll see you next time.
You've been listening to New England Lacrosse Journal's Chasing the Goal podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Spotify, TuneIn, Stitcher, and other podcast platforms. Also, listen to the podcast on the website, laxjournal.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at @NELaxJournal, Instagram at New England Lacrosse Journal, Lax Journal on Facebook, and our email address, chasingthegoal@laxjournal.com. Join us again next time as we go chasing the goal. Chasing the Goal, a Siemens Media podcast.